This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Yesterday, President Trump pulled the United States from the Paris Climate Agreement, leaving the list of other 194 countries that signed on in 2015 to reduce greenhouse emissions. Trump said the agreement imposed, quote, draconian financial burdens, unquote, on the U.S., and that he would renegotiate the terms to make, quote, a deal that is fair. Maggie Hirth-Baker is here to fill us in on this historic decision. She's senior science reporter at 538.com. She joins us from NPR studios. Welcome back, Maggie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's talk about this. First of all, President Trump held this press conference announcing the withdrawal and his basis for pulling the U.S. out of the agreement.
Well, basically, his position is this is just a bad, bad deal. You know, in his speech yesterday, he told the audience at the White House that the agreement was designed to hobble U.S. economic success and transfer our money to other countries.
And it's interesting to note that in the agreement says the withdrawal period is 3 to 4 years. So it would not take place while he would be in his first term.
Well, there is one way that he could do that faster, and that would be to withdraw from not just this agreement, but from the 1992 UN treaty that the Paris Agreement is an outgrowth of. But that's considered a lot less likely. So, yeah, it kind of comes down to this sort of interesting reality where President Obama signed us into this treaty as an executive order, which means that Trump can just turn around and take us out as an executive order. But with all of this being done by executive order, that just means that the next president can double undo what Trump already undid.
And there has been a response from some mayors and other officials around the country.
Yeah, cities and states are signaling that they might be willing to stay in the agreement, even if the federal government does pull out. So the New York Times was reporting today that there are 30 cities, 3 states, and more than 100 companies that are going to band together to submit a plan to the UN about the Paris Agreement. And that's really interesting politically. That's something we're watching at 538, because if cities start entering into global agreements on their own, separate from the U.S. government, that's really weird.
Yeah, well, it's free for them to do that, right? They can do whatever they'd like, free of the
government. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's just definitely a different norm.
Well, you could apply that to a lot of things going on in Washington now. A different norm. That would be the title of your book. You wrote a story this week that looked at when the environment became a bipartisan issue. I've always wondered, what's your take on this?
So what was really interesting about this to me is that it sort of turns out that the fate of this agreement was kind of sealed all the way back in the early 1990s, which is when environmentalism really became highly partisan. So we were looking at several different lines of evidence. We were looking at how Republican congresspeople voted and also at polling on the beliefs and opinions of conservatives and liberals and Republicans and Democrats. And what we found is that there is this huge shift that you see starting around 1988 or so. And in just 3 to 4 years, you go very quickly from environmentalism being a fairly bipartisan idea to it being a complete non-starter in conservative circles. You know, Democrats got more entrenched around the same time period, too. But there's this big split that happened, and it wasn't there before, and it happened quick.
See, I always thought it had something to do with Al Gore's book and his participation in it.
Well, what the researchers I spoke with, Aaron McWright at the University of Michigan, he thinks that it actually has a lot to do with the Cold War. So he's working on this paper where he went back and read every issue of several conservative magazines between 1970 and 2014. And he saw the rhetoric shifting a lot in the late 80s, too. So you went with environmentalism sort of being this replacement for communism, actually, that there was this new threat to the free market. And you started seeing even these slurs tossed around, like people being called watermelons, green on the outside, but inside it's red.
Wow. Let's move on from this because we could be here all day long. Let's go on to a CRISPR. Well, CRISPR is an exciting topic. There are a couple of CRISPR trials happening in humans.
Yeah, so this week has been good news, bad news for CRISPR. On Tuesday, New Scientist reported that there are at least 20 new human trials that are kind of getting off the ground, most of them in China, a couple also in the UK. There's one that's supposed to be starting in the US sometime next year. And these include a trial of a technique to fight cancer-causing HPV virus, where researchers will actually take a gel containing that CRISPR machinery and put it directly on women's cervixes. So it'll kill the virus and infective cells, but leave the healthy cells alone. And this was really cool, but then later in the week, you got this other bit of news that there's a new study where researchers found that the algorithms that they've been using to predict unwanted side effects of CRISPR maybe don't work as well as we thought they did.
What do you mean by that?
Well, so CRISPR causes mutations effectively, right? And there are mutations that we want. And we know that there's this risk of it causing some mutations we don't want. So what people have been doing is using these algorithms to sort of predict the amount of mutations based on what genes you're targeting and, you know, how you're using the tool. But it turns out that this works better in a test tube than it does in an actual living body. So they did this study of a CRISPR fix for blindness in mice, and they successfully altered the gene that was causing blindness. You know, the mice could see, but they also found that it caused more than 1,500 unintended mutations that weren't predicted by the algorithm. You know, the mice didn't experience these high rates across the board. There were two mice that were particularly affected in ways that others weren't. But it's really hard to guess what gene impact, you know, what impacts these gene mutations would have. And cancer is always the big risk.
Yeah, CRISPR's not a very precise way yet. We've been talking this year about the solar eclipse. We're looking forward to that in August. There will be a lot of sun science happening. But NASA is sending a probe, first probe that go right into the sun.
Well, not right into the sun.
Close enough?
It's pretty close. 4 million miles, is that close enough for you?
I think so. It's a little toasty at that point.
It's definitely a little toasty. You know, what it's actually studying is the corona, which is kind of like the sun's atmosphere. And the corona is actually hotter than the sun itself, so 1.8 million degrees Fahrenheit, which is really hot. So the probe is going to be at least 4 million miles away from that in an area where it's only 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit. And it's expected that its mission will last until 2025, and then it'll just stay in orbit around the sun after that.
Collecting data. Has it got all kinds of heat-resistant material built around it?
It does, carbon composite materials. And one of the reasons that we're only doing this now is because these materials just became available.
Right.
And before that, we couldn't have done this kind of study.
Visiting the corona. I'll drink to that, Maggie. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Maggie Kurth-Baker is senior science editor, a science reporter, senior reporter, all those things at 538.com. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. The globe continues to warm, and with it, the oceans. How will warmer waters affect the fish we eat? Researchers working with NOAA have been looking in particular at the Northeast Continental Shelf, all those coastal waters from North Carolina to the Gulf of Maine. As is a common theme with climate change, there's some good news and some bad news. And my guest is Dr. Kristen Kleisner, senior scientist with the Environmental Defense Fund's Fisheries Solutions Center and lead author on the research. She's based in Boston. Welcome, Dr. Kleisner.
Thanks, Ira. Thanks for having me.
It sounds like there's some good news here if we like lobster or spiny dogfish.
That's right. We did a study with colleagues at NOAA and the Nature Conservancy to try to understand what we call suitable thermal habitat for these species. So that's basically a picture of the water temperature and the depth that individual species are most commonly associated with. And the upshot was that we found some potentially significant increases for many species, including things like summer flounder, striped bass, and Atlantic croaker. Those are all species that are currently caught off the more southern portions of our coastline, and they're associated with warmer waters. And these guys might do pretty well as climate changes and new areas of suitable thermal habitat open up for them.
But the news isn't so good for other fish we'd like to see more of.
Right. On the flip side, we saw that the picture was not so rosy for species like Atlantic cod, Acadian redfish, and some of the other species that are found further north on the shelf in the Gulf of Maine, for example. And of course, that's not to say that these species won't have plenty of suitable water temperatures off the shelf, maybe in deeper water or maybe further north outside of our study area. And again, it's good to remember that what we're doing is creating a picture of suitable thermal habitat that's defined primarily by water temperature and depth. And those are both really, really important factors for fish, but there are definitely other factors that are important that our study didn't account for. Things like ocean acidification, which mm-hmm. could strongly affect species like lobsters, which did really well in our study, or other animals with shells, or also species interactions. That could be a pretty big wild card.
Mm-hmm. Assuming we can accurately predict where the fish are going to move as the ocean warms, why don't we just go follow them, you know, and fish
them
there?
In terms of, fish them there? Well, I mean, some fishermen may choose to do that, but then, they're looking at traveling potentially quite a good distance from their home ports, maybe spending more fuel to catch the species they've traditionally fished. But, you know, there's going to be new species showing up off of our coast, and that could present some new opportunities. And I think anglers and fishers are going to need to be able to make modifications to their gear, maybe to catch these new species, or also have the ability to obtain quotas or permits to be able to go and fish these species.
Yeah, your research looks at, as I said, the Northeast Continental Shelf, but I'm imagining it could be applied to a whole bunch of other places.
Yeah, it definitely could. So our study used trawl survey data, but it also used a very high-resolution climate model, which is a little bit different than a lot of the research that's being done with the IPCC models. It's a tenth of a degree resolution in the ocean, so that's really, really fine scale right now, and it gives us a very clear picture of the oceanographic processes on the shelf, and that's what we used for our temperature predictions in the future to mm-hmm. be able to forecast, you know, the best areas for these species in terms of temperature.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Kleisner. Have a good weekend.
Thank you very much.
Kristen Kleisner is senior scientist with the Environmental Defense Fund's Fisheries Solutions Center. After the break, Hedy Lamarr was known as the most beautiful woman in Hollywood, but she waited almost her entire life to be recognized for having a brilliant mind as well. There's a new documentary that finally tells her story, what she was like as an inventor, inventing the having a patent that paved the way for Wi-Fi, other kinds of radio. We're going to talk all about this new film and stuff coming up after the break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. I first learned of the inventive talents of Hedy Lamarr from the story, cover story, in the spring 1997 issue of American Heritage magazine Invention and Technology. There she was on the cover, her glamorous Hollywood face, pictured on top of a patent with her name on it. A patent that was kept hidden by the Pentagon since the 1940s. Hollywood actress Hedy Lamarr was more than meets the eye. The most beautiful woman in Hollywood, and also the mother of Wi-Fi. That's right, she invented in her free time, from instant cola to a device to hold your used tissues. Her most passionate invention, a patent held for a secret communication system that now underlies most of our wireless technology. Today, we call it frequency hopping. Hedy's story is largely unknown to the public, partly because she didn't talk about it much herself. Here's her in an interview in 1969 on the Merv Griffin Show, just hinting about it.
Tell me something that I didn't know about you.
I want to be a simple... I am. I mean, very simple, complicated person.
She finally received professional acknowledgement by fellow inventors just 3 years before her death. For decades, screenwriters and producers have been trying to tell Hedy's story. Hollywood has never been interested. But now popular culture has finally caught up with the real Hedy. A new documentary, Bombshell, aired at the Tribeca Film Festival in New York this spring, and it will run on PBS next year. And a television miniseries is also in the works that will dig down further into her inventive side. Today we're going to revisit the brilliance of Hedy Lamarr and why telling her story is so important and why we're telling it now. Well, let me introduce my guest, Diane Kruger, actress, narrator in the recent documentary Bombshell, and she will portray Hedy in a forthcoming TV series about Hedy Lamarr. Welcome to Science Friday. Diane.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. Richard Rhodes, author of Hedy's Folly, The Life and Breakthrough Inventions of Hedy Lamarr, the Most Beautiful Woman in the World. That's the book he wrote. He's joining us from Moon Bay, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Hi.
Let me ask you, Richard, as Hetty said herself in 1969, she was very simple, complicated person.
She was complicated. I don't know about simple.
Well,
but someone who's going home at night instead of going to Hollywood parties and sitting at a drafting table with a bunch of engineering textbooks behind her coming up with inventions, that's not a simple person.
Hmm. Dan, you're someone who hadn't heard of Hetty's story until Richard's book came out, and now you're attached to these two projects about her. What makes her so compelling to you?
I was just fascinated with her story. You know, what attracted me most to her was that she already had this incredible life coming over to the U.S. from Austria, you know, escaping the war, convincing Louis Bemer on a boat to the U.S. to hire her as this actress. And then in her spare time as a non-trained engineer coming up with frequency hopping, I just found myself completely enthralled by her story.
Mm-hmm. Let's get into the story a little bit. Let me begin with you, Richard. Of course, as I say, a lot of people don't know she's the mother of Wi-Fi, the big frequency hopping patent. What got her working on all of that? Give us a little thumbnail sketch of that.
Hetty grew up in Vienna with a kind of debutante education. But her father was a bank director who was interested in science and technology and often walked her around Vienna pointing out how things worked. So she had a kind of background that she associated with a much beloved father. Then she married at 19 as a movie star in Vienna, in Hollywood, sorry, in Austria. She married the second richest man in Austria, who was an arms merchant, but also had an engineering firm that helped German and Italian military people solve technical problems. So once again, as a kind of arm piece at dinner, when all these generals and admirals were coming around, she listened and absorbed and learned. When she then got to Hollywood in the 1930s and began inventing on her own, she added to her skills. But then in the beginning, in that interim period between the time when the Second World War began in Europe and the time the United States joined that war, she followed the war with great concern. She was Austrian, so technically an enemy alien. Her country was attacking British shipping in particular and torpedoed ships loaded with children who were being moved from England to Canada to escape the German bombing of London and of the country. That horrified her. And it was then that she began thinking how she might be of help.
Mm-hmm. Diane Kruger, she also had a very daring life. As Richard said, she escaped her first husband and she had to establish herself in Hollywood. Do most people in Hollywood, or do they know about her, or did they know that of her when she was alive?
I don't know. You know, I only heard about her because of the book. And I think that's part of what makes me really want to tell her story, because it's an extraordinary one. And it is really rare to get to Hollywood and do everything that she did. And then her story of not being recognized for what she came up with, and really her family's journey to make sure that she finally will get the recognition that she deserves. It's a fascinating story to tell, and I think it's a great story for young girls to listen to.
Let me just add that there was an exodus from Germany and Austria with the coming of Hitler, of all sorts of artists, including actors with Jewish backgrounds. And Hetty's family were assimilated Jews. She was raised actually in a Catholic education, but Hitler was aware that she was Jewish and she had to get out. So they moved to America and England and other places, and it was a very difficult transition. Very few people managed it. She was one of the few who succeeded in her new world, changing language, changing culture, having to find another way to live. So it shouldn't be surprising, I think, that there was a great stress and strain pushing people to achievement in their new lives.
And she had this inventive side to her that a lot of people didn't know about. Did she go searching for equally minded folks in Hollywood who might be able to share their inventive side and work together?
You know, there was always in Hollywood in those days another world besides the one we know of talented and people with artistic gifts. She used to play chess with Man Ray, the American photographer who was part of the whole Surrealist movement in Paris in the 20s. So her idea of a good time was a quiet dinner party. She would go to dinner with people like Mitzi Gaynor and her gay husband, Adrian. And that was actually where she met an avant-garde composer named George Antheil, who helped her with her invention of frequency hopping when it came to that point.
He's the one who came up with the idea of using the piano roll, which he had used in his music,
yes,
to change, to hop the frequencies around like the dots on, like the slits and dots on the piano roll.
Exactly. They needed a way to change the frequencies automatically, and they worked out a way to have a scroll on the plane like a miniature piano roll and an equally timed scroll on a torpedo, which would flip the frequency from one point to another with little holes in the scroll just like the ones on a piano roll. It was a very clever use of the existing technology because digital technologies had not yet, of course, come along.
Our number 844-724-8255 if you'd like to talk about Hedy Lamarr. She didn't give up her inventive capacities or her inventive desires for a long time. I mean, in Bombshell, you talk about Howard Hughes fixing her up with her own little invention center, a little laboratory.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. Hughes loaned her a couple of chemists. She was working on a tablet that could be dropped into a canteen or a glass of water that would fizz up and make a cola drink. She thought that would help the soldiers in their travels around Europe during the war. But, of course, she didn't know any chemistry, so he loaned her a couple chemists. Unfortunately, she said that it didn't work. It was one of her few inventions that didn't work because different water qualities affected the fizziness.
Diane, you mentioned something earlier about you think this will be very helpful toward stimulating young women, girls, to see themselves differently. Last year, we saw the massive success of Hidden Figures, another story about brilliant women in science. Is there something in the air now in Hollywood that is bringing these stories about women scientists or women interested in science out to the public?
I don't know if it's just in Hollywood, but, you know, just judging for myself, I went to school and was never encouraged to, you know, really pay attention in physics or chemistry. And I love that she had a curious mind, that she grew up with a father who encouraged her to be curious and explained to her how things work. And I just took away such a positive message, you know, from her story. And as a girl, I feel like this is the moment where we should teach our daughters that they can do anything they want. And those typically male jobs should not, you know, that's not the law. So be curious. And if you're curious in this, you should have examples to look up to.
Mm-hmm.
We should mention that the Alfred B. Sloan Foundation in New York, which encourages communications on science and technology, was behind the film Hidden Figures, supported the development of that film, and has supported the development of my book, first of all, and now of the documentary that you're discussing.
Yeah.
So they have been greatly concerned to deal with this.
Yeah, I've been following this myself. Sloan is a funder of Science Friday, and we've, you know, have relations with them. And Doran Weber over there and I have been talking about this for 15 years.
Yes.
This movie has gone through all kinds of hoops, has it not?
Oh, it has. That's as complicated as a good invention, you know.
Yeah.
Why is that?
I don't know.
Why is it so hard to get... Yes, Diane?
Well, let me, from my experience, because I'm trying to produce the miniseries about her, you know, it's very difficult to explain an invention to people that want to be entertained, I guess, you know. And Hidden Figure was, I think, one of the first really great films that was both, in my opinion. And so all of a sudden there's this appetite in Hollywood of making stories, you know, that seemed impossible to crack, because clearly there's a hunger for it there. But then for Hedy in particular, what's been difficult is that her story is so big, and it spawned, you know, five decades. And you want to tell all of it, because she was, yes, she was an inventor, but she was also a brilliant woman and a great actress. And so, you know, you need the time to tell her story. And so it's kind of a hard nut to crack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm Ira Flatto. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Our number 844-724-8255, talking with Diane Kruger and Richard Rhodes about the lifetime of Hedy Lamarr. One of the very poignant scenes during the film in Bombshell depicts Hedy as having a difficult relationship with her own looks. She said they were a curse. She was so good-looking. She also had so much plastic surgery that when she grew older. Do you think not being valued for her mind affected her value of herself?
You know, I think we should be clear that, again, moving from one world to another, taking those great risks, she was made wealthy and famous by her looks. But it was not her looks that she valued. She valued her mind. She once said, "I can tell you how to be glamorous. All you have to do is stand still and look stupid." And that was the kind of conflict she had, because on the one hand, she was made rich and powerful by her looks, but on the other hand, the other part of herself was never recognized until late in her life.
Diane, you have
Yeah.
comment to make about that?
Yeah, I think Richard is right. And then I think as she grew older, I think she was very bitter. You know, Hollywood turned her back on her because now she wasn't young and beautiful anymore. And she was trying to keep that facade up, but clearly couldn't.
Yeah.
And nobody, you know, ever valued her for her mind. So she became a recluse. From her own family, and it's you know, it's a sad story, and at the same time, I think it's a wonderful story that she was alive when she was finally recognized for it. But she never, for example, made any money out of it. You know, they let the patent expired before, I think it's 20 years or 25 years. They never did anything about it, and they knew that she had it, but you know, she could never prove it, and until it was too late.
Let me go to a quick phone call to Noelle in Oakland. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, Ira. I'm calling because my great-uncle was an old-timey movie producer and director at MGM for many, many years. And I was looking through some books that I have of all the stills, and he directed a big, splashy movie with Hedy Lamarr and Lana Turner and Judy Garland. And they were kind of the three big stars, and it was called Ziegfeld Girl. And I was looking at the three women, and I was thinking about how, you know, for Judy and for what's-her-face, the blonde, things turned out so bad because of all of the negatives that came with that role as a movie star, the drugs and alcohol and all that. And I guess I thought Hedy's life turned out differently, but then I just heard what Diane said, and maybe it didn't, other than she became reclusive. But I thought maybe that kind of gave her some protection from the downfalls of that Hollywood life.
Yeah, she had her...
That was all.
Okay, well, thanks. So she had science as her buffer, is what I guess the caller was saying. Something else to turn to in Hollywood. We're going to take a break. We have a lot more to talk about. Hedy Lamarr with Diane Kruger, actress, Bombshell and forthcoming TV series on Hedy's inventive side, and Richard Rhodes, author of Hedy's Folly, The Life and Breakthrough Inventions of Hedy Lamarr. That was out in 2011 from Knopf. And our number, 844-724-8255. Stay with us. You can also tweet us at SciFry. We'll be back right after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday. We're talking with Diane Kruger, an actress and a producer and voice in Bombshell, the forthcoming TV series on PBS on Hedy Lamarr and her inventive side. Richard Rhodes, author of Hedy's Folly. Our number, 844-724-8255. A quick correction, and I want to ask if this is your misspeaking, Richard. We've gotten a lot of tweets coming in that you meant to say Janet Gaynor, not Mitzi Gaynor.
Ah, good. Thank you.
Hey, that's my ballpark, misnaming people. So I understand how that works. Diane, the upcoming series that you're working on, how many parts do you see, and how difficult are you going to find it to get all this stuff into a series?
I'm thinking we're probably going to aim for 5 to 6 episodes. You know, we want to start the story when she is 16 because I think her relationship with her dad is very, very important and something that I really cherish. And then, you know, it's we'll see. You know, we are still in developing stages, but I can see it being a six times 1 hour.
And are you going to play the lead role in this?
I'd like to. Yeah, I'd like to. I mean, you know, I am originally from Germany, so I'm always fascinated by people, you know, from my country, even though she's from Austria, but very close enough. And, you know, I don't know. Right. I'm fascinated with her.
I noticed that executive producer of Bombshell is Susan Sarandon, another famous Hollywood actress. What was her interest in this? I mean, what brought her on? Do you have any idea, Diane?
Probably the same reasons as for me. I think that, you know, we don't come across female stories enough, and hers is a really good one, and her story deserves to be heard and told, and I'm assuming she had a personal interest about her. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I found it interesting in watching Bombshell that Mel Brooks seemed to have a thing for her. Richard?
You know, the discovery late in her life that she was the inventor of this groundbreaking and fundamental technology of frequency hopping, or as it came to be called later, spread spectrum, which is now used in Bluetooth systems and communications with our GPS system, some cell phone systems. It's all over the place today. The group of men in the world of engineering who first discovered that the name on the patent, which was Hedvig Markey, was actually Hedy Lamarr, that happened to be her married name when she signed the patent, were all men of about the same age. They were guys who had fallen in love with her when they were teenage boys watching her movies. So they had kind of a built-in radar for being drawn to this whole curious story of their favorite Hollywood actress, the sexy Hedy Lamarr, being the inventor of this groundbreaking and fundamental technology that they were just beginning to work with as they moved into wireless digital, which is where it finds its place today.
I guess so. Mel Brooks' famous line, Hedley, in Blazing Saddles.
Which, unfortunately, is what about all that most people know about Hedy Lamarr, who are younger than, let's say, 50 years of age.
Yeah. What do you take away? And just a couple of minutes left here. Diane, what do you take away from, what's the message we should all take away from this whole experience?
For me, it is really about encouraging young people, and especially young women, to go into fields that are traditionally, you know, male-oriented, and to not judge a book by its covers. I think that, you know, I also think that the father-daughter relationship is something that I find myself as a girl really interested in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, anything is possible if you have a curious mind and you think outside the box. The world is your oyster, and I love that message.
Mm-hmm. Richard, any final thoughts?
Well, certainly people should be aware that the world is wide open to ideas from, they don't have to have advanced degrees necessarily. They don't even have to be working in the same field. Hedy just looked at the world with the eye of someone who wondered how she could make things a little better. Mm-hmm. And in that tradition came up with something really profound.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
And thank you.
You're welcome. Have a great weekend. Diane Kruger, actress and narrator in the documentary Bombshell that will be on PBS, I think, next year. And Richard Rhodes, author of Hedy's Folly, The Life and Breakthrough Inventions of Hedy Lamarr, The Most Beautiful Woman in the World. If you want to know about Hedy Lamarr, you should read that book. It's everything you'll know. You may remember last February, scientists revealed the chirp heard around the world. That is the sound of the first gravitational wave detected by the LIGO detector in 2015. Scientists are starting to amass a bit of a collection of chirps. The second gravitational wave was detected last June, and this week they announced a third wave. So what are these chirps telling us? My next guest is here to help decipher the sound and the data. Priyamvada Natarajan is a theoretical physicist who studies black holes, and she is a professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Yale University. She's not a part of the LIGO team, but we're always welcome and happy to have Priya back with us. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Happy to be back, Ira. And it's so exciting, right? In the last 24 hours, we have had human beings really disappoint us, but the universe has not disappointed us, right? That's what is so magical about it.
You have a way of with words, Priya. So tell us what is so... Okay, so it's the third time. Is third time a charm in this case? What would make it a charm in this case? What is so exciting about having it the third time?
Well, first of all... It's another combination of black holes doing the tango and hooking up. So this one was an event detected on the 4th of January this year. And you had two black holes that are about 31 solar masses and about 19 times the mass of the sun kind of in this death spiral and hooking up and then merging and producing these gravitational waves. So the first thing is that, of course, it ratifies the earlier detection, right? Mm-hmm. And truth be told, this is not the most massive pair. The first one that was detected was the most massive pair. If you remember, that was like 36 and 29 times the mass of the sun. So the issue here is that we never expected this mass range of black holes to be all that common. They're sort of bulkier than you would expect from the end states of stars. So that's what is kind of special, that we found a second one with roughly the same mass range as the first detection. And we never believed that, these were going to be the common kinds of merging events, right? So the interesting thing about it is, these events really, one shouldn't think of these events as just sort of sitting there slowly counting numbers, right? I was thinking about it, and, it's like a kaleidoscope. Like every event is like a little piece in the pattern. And once the whole sort of pieces fill in, we'll really understand something quite fundamental about how black holes are made and how they evolve and how they end up actually merging. So one exciting thing about this particular event is that it occurred farther away, 3 billion light years away. The other events occurred a billion light years away. So this is much farther away. And what is interesting about that is that we have like a sort of, you've pushed to a new sort of distance, which allows us to do a new fundamental test of general relativity. So, when you have light, optical light, and you put it through a prism, right, it disperses and it gives you rainbows. So gravitational waves are not like light. So according to Einstein's theory of general relativity, they should not disperse. There's no dispersion. And so because this is farther away, we can put some tighter constraints on whether there is dispersion. There's actually no dispersion detected. So we are still... very consistent with Einstein's idea of general relativity. So this event ratifies that. So the other fun thing about this event is that, from the in-spiral, from the template in-spiral and the data match, you can actually figure out the spin alignment or misalignment. So black holes can spin and they'll have a spin vector. And the plane that contains the orbit of the two that are tangoing, the two black holes that are tangoing, also has a spin vector. And the question is, are they all aligned? If they're all aligned, there's a lot of angular momentum that has to be lost before these chaps can actually hook up. And so the event would last longer, and so you would see sort of these signatures. So what they found with this event is that actually it was quite short, and it suggested that the spins were actually misaligned. So the deputy spokesperson of the LIBO collaboration, Laura Carinati, had a very nice analogy. It's like, you know, if you have these two tornadoes, right, and they are not, if they line up and then, you know, they line up with the orbit, then you'd have a much more massive tornado, right? So you take a lot more time to dissipate that energy. It's like the dissipating the spin. So here, the event was shorter, and so that tells you that the spins is a constraint on the fact that the spins were likely misaligned. Mm-hmm. And why is this cool? This is cool because then it offers a clue to how these black holes might have ended up as a binary pair. So, you know, there are a bunch of different scenarios. There are many scenarios on how you could make these black hole binaries. And one of them is, of course, you know, they could hook up after becoming black holes. Or they could start out as binary stars, and then one of them becomes a black hole, and then they could hook up when the second one becomes a black hole. So they could start as stars, or they could start hook up after becoming black holes. And the thing is, if they hook up as stars first, then because the binary star orbits are large, there's enough time for their spins to line up. They would be lined up, aligned. Whereas if they hook up after becoming black holes, their spins could be random because, you know, this sort of a this is what's called sort of a dynamical formation, right? So what this suggests, this event is very suggestive that these guys hooked up after becoming black holes. And that then points to the fact that this happens when you have close encounters in very crowded places. So you could have a nuclear star cluster or a globular cluster, and you could have a bunch of black holes. And that's, you know, the sort of, it's very interesting that we're getting a new window, new sets of clues to how these black holes could have ended up in this configuration.
Let me interrupt to say, I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about black holes with Priya Natarajan. You know, why is scientists so interested in black holes? I mean, okay, maybe there's a black hole. It's not a black hole. They spin, they collide, they put out gravitational waves. Why is so much, you know, so much interest concentrated? What will they tell us that we don't know, or what could they explain about the universe?
Well, first of all, look, they're the most enigmatic objects in the universe. I mean, they're crazy cool objects, you know, given what they do to light, what they do to matter around them, and so on. First, you know, is there's just that, right? That they are the strangest objects.
I'm good with strange. Strange is good.
You're good with that?
Yeah, I'm good with that.
And then we also know that the end states of massive stars would give you this kind of, you know, dense compact state, right? So we know that they correspond in a very real way to physics, right? So stars would burn up all their fuel, and if they're about 10 to 15 times the mass of the sun, they would end up as a black hole. So the other use that, you know, and then we see these supermassive black holes everywhere. So the question is, what's the link? How do these black holes grow? They seem to be a very important participant in the universe, right?
But well, let me interrupt because we're running out of time, and I have a fundamental question, and listeners are asking this. Will studying them get us any closer to uniting the gravity, the intense gravity they have, with the quantum side of physics? Will we find a gravitational particle that corresponds, and is there a predicted one that corresponds with, you know, quantum says it should be a graviton or something, right, that carries the gravity? Yes.
Right. So there are constraints now from this test of Einstein's theory of general relativity, but as I mentioned, with the dispersion, the fact that no dispersion is seen puts a limit on the mass of the graviton. But I think there have been some other interesting suggestions, right? Your favorite one and mine, the dream, that what if these black holes, right, 30 times the mass of the sun, could count for all of the dark matter in the universe? Alas, they can't quite account for all of the dark matter. But I think what black holes are going to teach us is test the limits of this theory of Einstein's theory of general relativity. We know it's not a complete theory, right? And that there has to be another covering theory. So any anomalies that we might find between the expected properties of black holes and what we can measure from LIGO events is going to bring us closer to what the covering model is.
Okay, I'm very happy with that because, you know, even Einstein, when he talked about quantum mechanics, he said it's okay for now, but it's going to be something bigger and better that covers everything. And that's basically what you're saying about
right. So the only disappointing thing at the moment is because, you know, the LIGO arms in India and Italy have not switched on. We can't quite find electromagnetic counterparts to this merger and gravitational waves, right? Looking for other signatures that would signal the environment because the error box is still too big. The swath of sky is just too big. So we just have to wait for more
Go over there and kick it on. Go ahead, Craig. Turn on those machines.
Right.
All right. Thank you. It's always a pleasure to have you on. Please come back and talk with us soon. Okay.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Dr. Priya Natarajan, theoretical astrophysicist and professor in the departments of physics and astronomy at good old Yale University in New Haven. Just a reminder before we go, we have a new show called Undiscovered. It's all about the twists and turns behind scientific discovery, and it's podcast. And this week on Undiscovered, after a big study of chronic fatigue syndrome comes out, many patients don't like the results, and they decide to investigate the trial's findings for themselves.
The PACE trials are garbage and not evidence for anything.
This week, an enormous row over chronic fatigue syndrome. It's about a paper in The Lancet.
And at a quick glance, this study looked really good, but the findings just didn't make any sense to me.
It's the latest episode of Undiscovered. It's a great series. It's our new podcast. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Google Music, wherever you get your audio stories. Check us out at undiscoveredpodcast.org, undiscoveredpodcast.org, and you will thank us for pointing that out to you. Charles Berquist is our director, our senior producer, Christopher Intagliata, and our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, and Katie Haller. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are engineers at the controls here of our studio partners, the City University of New York. You can email us at scifry@sciencefriday.com. And of course, we're up there on Facebook and tweeting at SciFry. Science Friday is out there every day. Is Science Friday now? I'm Ira Flatow in New York.